Welcome back, Mushroom Family. This is a new, brand new episode of Mushroom Bible Podcasts. We are a podcast bridging the gap between you, our beautiful, amazing, lovely, incredible listeners, and the wonderful, wacky world of fungi. So we bring in experts from all over the world to geek out with us and go on a journey into the wacky world of mushrooms and fungi. And let's prepare to tune in and shroom it.
Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Jim Fuller, who is the co-founder of Fable Food Company, a vegetarian, mushroom-based meat leveraging the unique characteristics of various fungi to recreate the taste and texture of meat. Jim is also a chemist, chef, and mycologist. He has a degree in chemical engineering from San Antonio. Then, after a few years of working in a spawn lab at Gourmet Mushrooms in the North Bay of San Francisco, he moved to the University of Melbourne to study agricultural science with a focal point in mycology. And his eclectic specialties have brought him far and wide, and we are so excited to welcome him on the show to share his stories and his knowledge. Jim, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really looking forward to talking about mushrooms.
For sure. And we just want to hear your catalyst, because you studied chemical engineering and now you're on the other side of the world working with mushrooms and approaching them with this mycological science. And how did this happen to you?
Yeah, good question. It all started, I guess, back while I was studying chemical engineering there. It started at San Antonio College and went to University of Texas at San Antonio. I took all of the courses to get a chemical engineering degree, and knew that I was transferring all my credits to eventually move to Australia, because just before then I met my would-be wife online. She lived in Australia and I lived in Texas at the time, and it all kind of worked out that she was able to come over there and sort of finish her PhD at University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. So while living together, knowing that we wanted to move back to Australia, I was basically just gathering all of my credits, my study units in chemistry, physical chemistry, all that kind of stuff, physics. And then I ended up taking all of the courses that are in the degree. And the problem is, I didn't want to graduate there. I wanted to graduate at university in Melbourne. So I actually put a pause on my chemical studies because, well, there was no more chemical studies to take. So I ended up started taking biologies, and I never was interested in biology. I was more interested in like mixing things and, you know, seeing things in the physical world change. It didn't have a whole lot to do there. But the throwaway sentence given to me by a biology professor in biology one university, we had like 2 or 3 days where mycology or fungi were actually focused on. And just a throwaway line that sort of resounded with me later was, there are not enough mycologists in the world. Didn't mean anything to me at the time. It's just that's just something that stood out, because we went through all this other stuff where, you know, you had the 60-year-old professor talking to you about sex and like the sexual organisms and all these sorts of things. And it was just so uncomfortable to watch. He's squirming with all these young kids and he's like, oh, thank God I got through that. And then we talked about fungi and we were just like, yeah, there are not enough mycologists in the world. And he just briefly went through it and then on to another thing. So didn't get a lot of exposure to it, but that line stuck with me. I was at the time a full-time chef in a fine dining restaurant there in San Antonio. So if you guys ever go down there, it's on the Riverwalk. It's called Biga on the Banks. James Beard nominated top 5, you know, one of the best restaurants in Texas, one of the best in the States. It was really cool. Before that, like for several years, I was working batch cooking in Mexican food. The stress and rush of the kitchen environment did me well. I worked really well. A lot of caffeine, just go in there, kill it, and then leave and then come back and do it again the next day. So, being that all worked well for me. I came from Midland, Texas. That's, I don't know if you guys know where that is, but it's about 5 hours west of you. 5 or 6 hours west. And that's where I kind of got all that Mexican cooking background. whenever I moved to San Antonio, the regional manager there was like, yeah, you don't want to keep doing this, man. You'll just kill yourself. Go, and I'll give you a reference, and you go to one of these better restaurants. And there are a few around. And it just so happens that I walked into Biga on the Banks with no culinary education, but a reference like they'd never heard, and just they saw something like, yeah, okay, well, we're starting up this new lunch menu. You can come in and prep for that. And, you know, it wasn't very long that it took me at all to sort of move through the entire restaurant working like as one of their principal dudes, just kind of cleaning up after everyone, you know, being available everywhere in the kitchen. What that did for me, though, it exposed me to all these different types of food that you never see whenever you're living in Texas and you just eat like chicken fried steak and catfish and okra and, you know, southern fried food. I was never exposed to ramps or kohlrabi or, you know, anything like that in my childhood and in sort of my early teens. It was more macaroni and ramen noodles. But then fine dining chef, I got my hands on all these cool ingredients and the coolest at the time. And I had no idea like their background, and just because I was given 3 days of topic on them in biology, I didn't really understand them as an organism. But what I did get inherently was they react really cool in a pan. They don't act like meat. They don't act like vegetables. They kind of act like both. They don't have the same flavors as either, but they kind of have the same flavors of both. They marry with everything. So if you can imagine, you can have mushrooms at every meal because they, you know, they work well with eggs. They work well with fish. They work well with chicken, fish, beef, lamb, all that. So I was just, you know, going from Texas with my background in cooking and loving mushrooms as a product that you can cook and not knowing anything about their lifestyle, and having that throwaway line from my biology class that there's not enough mycologists in the world. When we actually picked up to move to Australia, it was actually a stopover in California for a couple of years because my visa didn't go through. And my wife got an opportunity to take her skills from the University of Texas Health Science Center out to the Buck Institute in California. So she's a cancer researcher, dealing with age-related diseases, cancer, all that. So Buck Institute was designed by Ian Pei. It was all this really brand new thing, and it was in Novato, California. That's sort of the North Bay area of San Francisco. And I thought, cool. You know, we'll go out there. I'll take a couple of years off, from the restaurant. I'll take a couple of years off from school so I can still finish my degree when we go to Australia. So I was looking for science jobs, and it took a couple of months, but eventually I came across, are you familiar with Craigslist? Yeah, yeah. So in Australia, we don't have Craigslist. So I typically ask that question, but yeah, so I know. But we have something similar. It's like Gray's Auctions or something. It's nowhere near as big and cool. But I used to go on Craigslist a lot, and that's where I found all my opportunities. And one of them was, spawn supervisor at, Gourmet Mushrooms. And that's all it really said. It didn't have a whole lot that was enticing. But spawn sounded cool, you know, and, you know, it was kind of a supervisory role. So it was, you know, not just like an entry level thing. I thought, hey, you know, I'll go try it. Mushrooms are cool. And I went to Gourmet Mushrooms in Sebastopol, California, where I was introduced to David Law, Chris Bailey, and they gave me a tour around the farm. The bottle farm, no less, you know, I wasn't introduced to any other sort of growing other than the very first was introduced.
Yeah, that's the superior form, the bottle.
I know. Like, I had no idea. I had no idea. I was walking into the Cadillac, you know? So, I walked around it. I smelled the smells. I felt the surge of vibration, like just warm walking through there with all the biological activity. And that was the first time. And, you know, forgive me, but I took three days of mycology or fungi in my biology class. But that was the first time I heard mycelium. The word, which was shocking because what I did remember from my biology studies was brain function, brain activity, brain structure, and the myelin sheath between, you know, axon and neuron was something that I knew was super important. And if you could sort of build on that, that you'd have like enhanced brain function. And I was almost certain that when Chris Bailey said mycelium, that he said myelin. So I just had the wires crossed in my head, but it so excited me. I was like, it's a brain growing in those jars. And you can, like, not only is it food, but it's an intelligence. But I didn't realize how right I was, but I was wrong.
Yeah.
So I approached it with the idea that I was working with all of this neural network and that I was going to go and sort of start playing with that. And then I just fell down the rabbit hole from there. I picked up initially what you're exposed to, like all the Stamets books, picked up Aurora's, All the Rain Promises, got the big one, Mushrooms Demystified, which is probably to this day still my most used book, even here in Australia. The Mushrooms Demystified, just, it's so well written about how much stuff it covers. And at least if it just covers off stuff in the most generic of ways, and then it kind of builds out quite specifically in the directions, it's just one of the most interesting to show to people and say, look, you can get really, really complex, or you can sort of be pretty easy and on the surface when you're doing these things. But anyway, so that just spawned my love of taxonomy. It spawned my love of understanding, all that stuff. So yeah, of course I took the job. They loved the fact that I had a massive science background, but no real on the ground sort of expertise in growing mushrooms. So that sort of spawned it all. And it's North Bay Area, San Francisco. Mushrooms grow everywhere, and you have a lot of people there who are passionate about mushrooms. So not only did I get into working on the Cadillac of farms with the right mindset, you know, to make food and medicine out of them, but I was there in like the Pacific Northwest, where it rains almost all the time. Lots of things that are well researched, well known. You can walk out and identify everything. I got exposure to lots of folks at the time. You know, Glenn came into Mycopia Gourmet Mushrooms not too long after I started there, and went out with Chris Bailey a lot and met up with Tom Volk and a whole bunch of these other like names that that just ended up being so important that I didn't realize how important I was, you know, how important of the things that I was exposed to at the time. It was just like that cosmic aha. I know I want to do this forever. I know that this is a thing. They stuck me in the farm and I started working with the spawn and loved it. And what happened then was that I don't have a background in computers. It was all science, pure science. But they stuck me on the sort of data capture of the business, which at the time I thought was kind of the most boring thing possible, because I love to see the physical play out. You know, like, you like to grow them. You want to go out there and get your hands wet in the substrate and sort of dig into all the bottles and smell and look at the contaminations and wonder what's going on, all that kind of stuff. But, I got, you know, I'm collecting the data, and they said, you know what? You need to collect it from here to here, from the beginning to the end. And it was Excel spreadsheets as far as the eye could see and as long as the day was long, you know, like Excel, Excel, Excel. And I thought, I'm no computer whiz, but I think we can kind of put all these things together in a database. I don't know how to build one, but I'd like to have a crack. And I did. I had a crack at building what is now still used. It's called the, I think, MycoTrack database. Being on the ground with that sort of bottle system day to day, every one of those bottles is an experimental unit. So it like trains you in all kinds of areas that you don't realize, in data capture and statistics and this and that. But yeah, I developed all these algorithms to give them information on, you know, all the batches of stuff that are coming into the farm that are then getting mixed in certain ratios for all the different varieties of mushrooms they grow, whether they be culinary of the 6 or 7 different strains they have, and then of the nutraceutical, you know, up to 50, who knows how many they have now. But it sort of captured all those, captured the origin of them, and then applied them to substrate, and then through the whole process, concocky sort of taking them out and spreading them out into the rooms, and then harvest data. So I just, like, within the scope of a couple of years, got all of this information about mushroom growing, about materials that they grow on, about all the different things that you can do to sort of encourage them to grow all at once, you know, and both culinary and medicinal. And then not only did I get to do that, but I got to walk around in the Pacific Northwest for those couple of years and sort of learn how to apply names to porcini and chanterelles and, you know. So to answer your question, how did I get started? It's a big, long story. Took about 15 minutes, but that's, you know, that really got me into gourmet. And I got there for a couple of years, and I've stayed in touch with those guys. And, yeah, every time we go overseas to a conference, which, you know, right now, weeping because those aren't happening. And I've got a real itch to speak mushrooms to people. So you can tell I'm a bit excited.
Welcome. And how did your chemical engineering background fit into all this? And then how did that transition to you, you know, I'm guessing, you know, because you had a culinary background, you just morphed it all together. But, how did those two or three things weave together?
The chemical engineering thing, like, I didn't realize how much it would play a part in what I do. But it was really basically just like the building block understanding of what biological systems do physically, and then how that presents itself chemically. And then, you know, come down the track 10, 15 years later, I'm working with those chemical building blocks with the physical biological building blocks, you know. So it's more like the chemistry has been a major sort of benefit to me later on, but it was a major driver of interest early because they had, you know, 47 to 50 different nutraceutical strains, and knowing that food is function and functional foods are really interesting, and mushrooms are probably the most functional of all foods. That function doesn't just come from their biology. That function comes from those little things that they're spurting out, which are compounds, you know, like when you talk about chitin. You know, you talk about mushrooms have chitin in their cell wall. Well, yeah, but that's not all there's going on there. There's a whole complex of things that are going on. There's proteins and chitin and glucans, and there's like, you know, they're all different. So the chemical engineering thing, more about an understanding that it's not just, you know, A plus B plus C equals D in the biological world. There is a, you know, a whole bunch of tangential calculus that's going on there with the with the chemistry as well. So, didn't really tie into like driving anything professionally other than major interest. But now, being, you know, in Fable, we'll talk about in a bit, I guess. I sort of work to sort of look at how the chemistry works and how it can help me sort of make stuff happen. But, you know, I realized that mushroom farming was a big sort of intersection between farming and science, art, and it's like mushroom growing sort of became to me what chemistry was, which was a very central science. Chemistry, it belongs at the center of, you know, physics and biologies and all that other, you know, sciences. It's a central science. Mushroom, to me, became like a central organism. Everything must sort of go through here somehow.
I'm super excited to dive into the culinary science behind working with mushrooms. But before we get there, could you tell us more about Fable and what exactly you're doing?
Yeah, sure. So jump ahead to just beginning of 2019. Fable wasn't a thing yet, but I had met with one of the co-founders. So I was working, I started working for him on his organic agaricus mushroom farm. This was coming off the back end of working 5 years in the fruit and veg wholesale market here in Melbourne, selling mushrooms, because I was sort of, I don't know, I just got out of growing, got out of consulting, and there was a lot of money in the wholesales thing. So I did that for 5 years, but I wanted to get out of that. And the opportunity presented itself to go work at this agaricus mushroom farm. It was the largest organic agaricus mushroom farm here in Australia. I had previously worked for Costa Mushrooms, which is the largest mushroom farm in the Southern Hemisphere, in their spawn lab, which is a cool story. That was after I failed in business once I moved here. So after backing up all that way, let's bring it back to meeting Chris, the co-founder. He brought me in because he knew of my background with GMI, because he had checked out my LinkedIn and stalked me there. And as soon as I got out of the, as soon as I said I wanted to get out of the wholesale market, he was like, yeah, yeah, come work for me. We'll figure out a thing for you. You'll be growing exotic mushrooms, or you'll be adding the exotic mushrooms to our range, or we'll be doing something with exotic mushrooms or fermentation or medicinal, or we'll find something. You know, he's like, just come across and we'll do something. So did. And, it turned out that the mushroom market, the agaricus mushroom market, took a hit that it hadn't seen in 4 years right as soon as I started there. So we didn't jump into exotic mushrooms. We didn't jump into fermentation, and then we kind of got, I was kind of straggling, you know, the business wasn't making a whole lot of money like it had been, didn't have all that extra cash around. So I was sort of remanded to working with what I had available. And what I noticed was we were throwing away a couple of tons of agaricus mushroom stems a week. And think back to Costa mushroom days, we were throwing away about 70 tons a week, 75 tons a week of mushroom stems. The major issue there, and I don't know, how much do you guys know about agaricus? Do you know a bit or anything?
We've had William Goss, who used to work at Monterey Mushrooms, which is the biggest agaricus
farm in
North America. Yeah. I know it's very different in terms of cultivation.
There's a whole lot of differences. So at Costa Mushrooms, I worked in a spawn lab there, and we used MSL spawn. So that's actually provided by Monterey Mushrooms. So like all the science behind MSL, all the equipment, they had licensed all that technology. So I got to work with that system for 3 years here, managed a spawn lab. And that's, you know, why anyone would have me in agaricus farm anyway. So agaricus is slightly different. The retail market for agaricus has very tight stipulations on what is acceptable. So, you know, the cap can be up to a certain diameter before it's called a different thing. So there's buttons, cups, flats. I think they're called something different in the States, but I can't remember now. There are buttons, opens, and I can't remember what they were called, but maybe that's a terminology that sort of works around the world. The thing is that the stem on buttons and cups can be no longer than half the diameter. So in the case where you're growing on a mushroom farm and you need to grow a lot of mushrooms on the bed, they actually need to grow kind of long stems so that the caps can round out. But they also need to cut those off so that they can pack them up and sell them for retail. So there's a good amount of loss that goes on there, which is all clean food. But mycelium at the surface of the peat, so in the agaricus mushrooms, they put peat across the surface, a non-nutritional layer, and it's a water-holding layer. The mycelium sort of knots up and forms primordia just under the surface. And then as they grow, their connection to that peat sort of isn't just all mushroom on one side and all sort of mycelial network on the other. It's like mycelium, then some peat mixed around in there. The mycelium sort of grows around it and sort of roots itself. And then the mushroom forms on top of that. So the first, you know, couple of millimeters, if not the first centimeter or so of connection, is inclusions of peat and whatever else is in the peat. So harvesting over the past 100 years or whatever has gone to just cutting off the retail requirement and packing that. And then that whole bottom is called a chog, and it goes in a bin, and that goes and gets fed to animals like cows or goats, or it goes into a field to become compost. And the thing is that those things don't just break down. They require something to sort of break them down. And just like you or I, where if we eat a mushroom without sort of cooking it and exposing the inner material, like that chitin complex isn't going to allow us to sort of digest any of it. So that's kind of similar to what goes on with animals. You know, like, I guess the ruminants have a little bit better of a chance, but they're not working with breaking down chitin, they're working down with breaking down cellulose. So they have bacterial fermenters in their guts that do that with cellulose, but not chitin. So I just looked at that and thought, well, it's a massive injustice because there's a whole lot of food there. Totally. And yeah, whether we can separate out that Pete or not has been the issue since the beginning. And it's never been worthwhile for a mushroom farm to sort of double cut because it adds labor. And labor is the highest cost in mushroom growing because it, you know, requires the most time picking. All the mushrooms are hand picked. You know, mechanical picking, you don't get the same brilliant quality. Well, like maybe with robotics and that coming, you will, but right now, in all the years leading up to now, you get a picker who can pick sort of 20 kilos an hour, putting three or four mushrooms in his hand and nicking off all of the chogs and then packing it straight into a retail punnet. That's great. That's like the way that you can make money off of growing mushrooms. But if it takes them, you know, 4 hours to pick that 19 kilos and they're being very dainty, it's difficult. So that's not something that any mushroom farm wanted to introduce. So I looked at, well, how are we going to extract food out of there? How are we going to get it that happens? So I spent a bit of time working on that, but also spent a bit of time just cutting the peat off and working with the agaricus waste on its own, and ended up developing a mushroom-based meat out of that. And that became very interesting. So about 6 months in, we decided, let's take that and run with it. Let's do a business making mushrooms and, you know, specifically agaricus mushrooms, but, you know, whatever other mushrooms we can work on, into meat. And that, you know, we pulled out, got on the trail doing some investment sort of search, got introduced to some pretty big investment people. And one of them was someone who Chris, my co-founder, like sort of idolized and said, like, whatever they want us to do, that's what we're going to do. And that company, asked us to go meet up with somebody else who they were also looking at because we had complementary skill sets. So we were working with making a mushroom based sort of mince or a meat patty, burger patty. And, the other guy, Michael Fox, who ended up becoming the third co-founder, was working on a more shredded style, or a slow cooked meat style. And, we met, decided, you know, we could be competitors, so we don't want to share a lot of information with the guy, but we'll meet for coffee and see where it goes. So we met for coffee over lunch, left the rest of the day open, just in case. And we ended up spending the entire day together. We ended up trying each other's products later that evening. Everyone sort of fell in love with everyone. It was a Cinderella tale, you know, it worked out quite well. And we said, all right, this is what we're doing. Let's do this. Let's develop this thing into something. And then Fable was born. So officially sort of in the last quarter of last year, Fable, you know, got signed in and we all three became co-founders. We launched our product in December, at a restaurant here in Melbourne. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Heston Blumenthal. I didn't realize that he wasn't necessarily that massive of a name in the States, but I was a chef in the States, and in the chef community, he was a massive name in the States. So I just sort of applied that to everybody over there, thinking everybody knows Heston. But how about you guys? Have you heard of Heston?
I had not until you.
Yeah, so I guess he's like a big name in, definitely a big name in Europe. He's got one of the best restaurants in the entire world. And in the chef community, people would, you know definitely the name of his restaurant and like what he is. Yeah. He's like molecular gastronomy, if you know that. So he was like always a scientific style chef, and he was sort of my chef inspiration. Whatever I was actually, you know, back in the kitchen at Big on the Banks, like I would look to Heston books and Heston shows and follow what he was doing to sort of like mimic what I would like to learn, you know, and how I'd like to cook and all that. So I actually ended up speaking to Heston, getting introduced to him in Thailand, through another long story, but we launched our product at Dinner by Heston. So that's the name of his restaurant, Dinner by Heston. And you know, that's a pretty big, cool thing, cool ability to have Heston sort of preparing your food, or Heston chefs preparing your food, for all of your launch events and all of the people who are going to be writing articles for you. You know, they're looking at these dishes that are amazing. And he turned our mushroom-based meat into snails and into, just One was an ice cream that he created a caramel for out of our mushroom-based meat. So that was pretty cool. Fable is now available in retail stores here in Australia. It's on, I don't know, it was before COVID, it was on about 50 different restaurant menus. But because of restaurants being a little bit disrupted, I'm not sure how that's gone. Like, my end is in the development side, so I'm not in touch with sort of the day-to-day who's on and off with sales. But, you know, we're always going harder and doing more, developing the next thing. But yeah, Fable slow cooked style meat is our thing. It has that whole, it's taken off. It's doing well.
Yeah. It's such a funny series of unlikely events to end up creating a product like Fable. So what exactly is it? It's the stems of agaricus, and how did you treat it? And like, what else is infused in it? I mean, how do you actually turn the stem of the agaricus into product?
Well, there's a bit of IP in there. So I'll talk about the structures and the sort of textures. But it wasn't agaricus that we ended up developing into Fable. So agaricus is in the pipeline for product number 2 and 3. So that's what me and Chris were sort of working on. And then Michael was working on the shredded meat product, and that was with shiitake mushrooms. So he was most of the way along the development pipeline there. But sort of when we came in, had the technical skills to sort of pick it up, run with it, and develop it and launch it like immediately almost. That is more, it's shiitake. Shiitake mushrooms. Shiitake mushrooms being dried, being very hardy mushroom. You can pull them apart and, you know, they have shreds. They actually shred up like meat. So having the idea to be really minimal as possible processing, with as little additive as possible in anything that we put in there, being natural, you know, like having this whole ethos is why I wanted to get into mushroom-based meat and why Chris wanted to get into mushroom-based meat. And it just so happened that Michael wanted to do the same thing. So having that alignment was great, because it means that we're not turning out mushrooms that have been glued together with, you know, who knows what. And it's not gone through massive, incredibly destructive cooking processes that take away like the essential greatness of what the base product is. So you translate, you know, all the good mushroom stuff into the final product rather than sort of removing it all and destroying it all and then just working with the benefits of it. You know what I mean? So shiitake being really great at shredding, gives us the ability to basically just put in sort of the right elements to recreate the taste and texture of meat. Well, shiitake is already very high in glutamates, so that umami is there sort of inherently. So we don't have a lot to do to change the flavor. We just need to sort of coerce it to be more meaty. And that's basically with a cooking process. And then, you've got a couple of different things in there added to sort of just sort of pop out more meaty style. And that's really within the seasoning. So if you look at the label, the food, it basically tells you everything that's in there. None of it just says natural flavor with a hidden meaning. There's yeast extract. Which is known to be quite meaty. It's pretty interesting why. And then, you know, white black pepper, salt, soy sauce, those sorts of things. Just bringing out and amplifying the umami that's already there. And then, because we don't use any animal fats and we need the saturated fat for the mouth coating sort of succulence, there are a couple of things, you know, in the plant world that work out, and none better for our liking than sort of coconut oil. You know, it's got really great praise on one side, and it's got, you know, on the other side, people are starting to talk negatively about it. But I think anything that's got a lot of exposure sort of has people on both sides. We're using it for the function to recreate a taste experience or and the meat eating experience for people. You know, people say, why do you want to create meat for vegetarians or vegans? You know what? They will just eat vegetables and they're happy with that. And to a degree, that's right. You know, they're very happy just eating vegetables. But the main thing is, like, we want to help people to reduce their consumption of meat. And I was a vegan. I became a vegan for a year just to, you know, it had no, like, ethical background in, like, doing this for a business purpose. I literally saw that we need to look at how we can sustain resources in the world. And whenever you're living and breathing mushrooms, you know, and talking about starting a mushroom farm and how they're, you know, they themselves are regenerative and sustainable, and you're living and breathing that every day, it sort of makes you feel like a liar if you go home every day and just have, you know, half a kilo of meat and spread that out over your family and know that, you know, for that, you spent 5,000 liters of water and, you know, 5 kilos of grain.
Right. I think faux meat is the future, especially with mushrooms, and we're seeing a lot more. One thing that I thought was interesting was this real meat with mushrooms, kind of 50-50 blend. Mm-hmm. And so you're still getting the actual meat, and it still tastes the same, but you're kind of supplementing it with mushrooms. So you talked about agaricus, you talked about shiitake. I know you ran a morel farm for a little bit, and I'm sure there's tons of different mushrooms that you worked with. I know this is probably a really hard question, like picking your favorite child, but do you have a favorite mushroom to, one, to cook, but second, to eat? And it could be a mushroom dish as well.
Yeah, so I've been asked that question a lot, just, you know, having the people around me. Expecting an answer, and it is difficult to pick. So I usually just break it up into a couple, both wild and culinary, wild and cultivated. So in the wild varieties, I always tend to lean towards chanterelle and morels. And then for cultivated varieties, typically sort of shiitake and maitake. Yeah, but that always sort of changes depending on how I feel.
For sure. So I've seen videos on how to cook mushrooms, and I feel like this is a whole science that most people cooking at home don't fully understand. But what's the ideal way to cook mushrooms? I've heard you shouldn't use oil because it'll suck it all up, and then you'll be getting like tablespoons and tablespoons of oil with your food, which you probably don't want to do, and that you should actually cook them with water. And you should do it really slowly. It might depend on the mushroom. What have you learned about cooking these chitinous bodies?
Yeah. You heard right. So you got hot metal and you've got a mushroom, right? The mushroom itself doesn't necessarily have any water outside of the cell. It's all sort of locked up in there. That's how it sort of grows really quickly. It sort of absorbs and just massively swells with water. You put it into a pan, and if you've got no oil, then what'll happen is sort of it'll burn and the structures will sort of just seal themselves off. You'll eventually end up with a waterlogged burnt mushroom. So you need to sort of provide something in between. If you start with oil or fat, the temperature of the oil or fat is sort of way outside of what the boiling temperature of water is. So it'll sort of encourage those cells to burst, but then sort of flash evaporate the water right at that surface, and the oil will sort of jump into the cellular structure and just sort of replace it and waterlog it, because it'll kind of lock out the other water from getting evaporated. So in a nutshell, if you start really, really slow and low, you can work with fats, and it'll happen. But if you work with like high heat and fats, it you're going to end up with really plump, juicy, but oily, waterloggy, gray, sluggy things. So that's where a lot of people kind of fail. A couple of different ways that you can encourage the water from the mushrooms, and half of the dry material that mushrooms are is actually kind of soluble stuff anyway. You can stick them into a pan and just crowd them. So just stick them maybe like a sauce pot with a lid on top and turn the heat on really, 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 really low. And then that'll encourage the cells to start breaking open and the water of the mushroom to just come out and then start cooking just like that. The more it comes out, the more will be encouraged to come out, and you don't really need to add any water, but that is a really long process. It could take half an hour to an hour for, say, a couple of hundred grams to sort of fully release their water. And then you want, whenever you get the water out, you actually want to sort of do something with it. You don't want to throw that water away because it's full of those soluble proteins and carbohydrates, and you want to actually reduce that down to where most of the water is evaporated away and the soluble stuff starts concentrating. And that's when you'll start developing rich, deep brown colors, and that Maillard reaction starts kicking in where there's proteins and sugars that are around with heat that can go sort of, you know, over the boiling temperature of water. That starts happening as soon as you start getting rid of most of your water. And then that sort of stuff will cook down on the bottom of your pan, and you can then sort of throw in whatever fats or oils, and then like your aromats, like onions and garlic, and actually cook those to how they normally would cook. Sear them, brown them. You're doing the same thing there, developing the flavors, and then maybe hit it with a little bit more water to wash all of that stuff that's cooked to the bottom of the pan that's nice and brown and Maillard umami, and just kind of kick it back up onto the mushrooms. And that's a mushroom sort of dish that a lot of people just haven't had the opportunity to experience like that. But you can absolutely achieve it with mainly just the water of the mushrooms themselves. And then just right at the very end, it only takes about a minute or so to sort of just encourage it with, you know, a little bit of oil. 1 tablespoon of oil for that whole 100 or 200 grams of mushrooms that you put in your stock pot, plenty. And, you know, oil and salt is just enough to sort of have a very, very flavorful mushroom dish. So I'd say that maybe that is 95% of the mushrooms react very well with that. But not everyone. I wouldn't do a gnocchi like that. And, you know, you would be selective for which ones you wouldn't follow that process. But it's pretty good and ubiquitous for most.
Right. And it's so easy to mess up mushrooms. At least in my opinion, you know, a lot of times I'll see mushrooms on the menu. And a lot of times it'll just say mushrooms. And I know it's button mushrooms, and I honestly can't stand button mushrooms. I've only had them a few times in my life where they're actually cooked well, and spiced well, and I'm like, these are really good, you know. But most of the time they're just slimy and just like really gross. Like, I'm not a fan, and they're a lot easier to mess up than other mushrooms that are a little more, you know. I think they taste a lot better. So I really like that technique of cooking, and I'll have to re-listen to this over and over again as I'm cooking mushrooms again, because it's, you know, it's unfortunate because most people are like, I don't like mushrooms, you know, and my brother, like, he will not eat mushrooms. And I know a lot of people, especially when we're vending, you know, in person, they'll come up to our booth, and I used to do farmers markets and everything, and they'll be like, I hate mushrooms. They'll go out of their way to tell me that. And it's like, well, you haven't had the good ones, or they haven't been prepared well enough by someone who knows what they're doing. So this is awesome. This is great, especially for everyone in quarantine right now, you know, cooking more than they normally do. And is it true that you should cook all mushrooms? I know, you know, people eating psilocybe, they don't cook those. Or truffles, I know you can shave on top. That's not technically a mushroom, but are there any exceptions to the rule?
There's probably just a couple of logical exceptions. One is the taste and texture in its fresh state. Like, enoki is great. It's very crispy and sweet. And, you know, it doesn't have that massive astringency or bitterness whenever it's fresh. So that's the first consideration is, you know, what does it taste like when it's fresh? And the second is like the environment that it came from. So I wouldn't be necessarily picking and eating wild mushrooms fresh just because of, you know, the environments that they're in. But there are a couple of exceptions. One being, Fistulina hepatica, which is very citrusy, you know, like quite crisp as well. Interesting looking, but it's sort of under a protective layer of jelly. So if you scrape that off, then you kind of know that, you know, there's not anything growing up there, and you can do your best to sort of clean it all off. And it works really well fresh. Yeah.
I've actually heard people, that's the beefsteak fungus, if anyone is not adept at their Latin names. But I've actually eaten that fresh when I found it in the wild, and I've heard of people making sushi out of that.
Have you ever tried sushi, but being in the mushroom sales in the wholesale market there, I often had it coming through and was often cutting it open and displaying it in different ways to people. So I've had it raw several times and then raw in a sandwich or in a salad, you know, just kind of showing off its ability. But yeah, sushi seems like a really cool one.
That's so interesting that it's an exception. And I wonder what about it is better for our guts or just easier for our bodies
I don't know that we do get any real benefit out of that other than mastication, where you break apart those cells and then of course you'll get, you know, whatever the cellular contents that come out as liquid. But for the most part, your stomach acids, you don't really go breaking down the mushrooms. And that's something that I should, you know, say very clearly, that whenever you're boiling mushrooms, you can't overboil them. You can boil them for hours or days even, and you're not going to overcook them because that cellular structure is very robust. So that sort of makes it really fail safe, especially like I go out and do wild mushroom tours and I cook all these different mushrooms together in one pot, and I'll start talking and I'll just be cutting and throwing in mushrooms, but I'll keep adding water as I go. And then when the mushrooms that I can see are cooked to the degree that I like them, sort of like al dente, like noodles, you know, they're not going to go past that. They get to a point where they give up so much water, they're not going to give up their own cell structure like zucchini or a vegetable that'll break apart because it's mainly just cellulose that's falling apart. That's not going to happen. So you can boil and boil and boil, and that's what I suggest you do. And for people who say that they don't like the taste because they haven't been cooked right, just cook the absolute crap out of them in water. Seriously. Boil, right. Boil, boil until you're happy, and then reduce all that water out. It'll take a little while, you know, 10, 15 minutes to reduce all that water, but put a good amount of water in there. That'll really get them cooked. And then all that good amount of water becomes a basic stock. So you can throw in, you know, aromats and flavors into the stock, and then very, very flavorful. Yeast extract, you know, a lot of people use that as sort of a meaty thing. That's just the cellular contents of a fungus, right? Yeast. They broke it apart, they reduced it down, and then they turned it into a powder so that you can sprinkle it onto, into a bowl with some hot water, and they call that like beef gravy. And that's all around the world. It's beefy. It's gravy-like. People don't realize it's yeast extract. They think it's beef, you know, which is really beefy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that there's so many like meat facsimiles within the mushroom world. You know, you have a shrimp with the words, you have the beef steak, you have the lobster mushroom, and I love it. I feel like there's a mushroom for almost every fleshy dish that we're used to.
Definitely agree.
So I have a question about cooking mushrooms by soaking them in vinegar. I just heard someone say that you could do this, and they did that with morels. I think they dried the morels and then soaked them in vinegar.
I've seen this with woodier mushrooms in China, and it's so good. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's honestly one of my favorite dishes of all time.
Agreed.
I think I was half my plate on every single meal was just like vinegar soaked woodier mushrooms, and my if I got cut, it probably wouldn't be a good because it prevents clotting. So I would have been bleeding for hours, but I would have loved it because they're so good.
100%. And you notice that half of what is great about that is that they retain that sort of crispiness. So if you were to cook like this and stick mainly to vinegar, only lightly salting and sugaring, because those are, they draw the moisture out and sort of break down the cells a bit more. So yeah, you can cook with just salt or just vinegar. But vinegar itself, it more just sort of encourages the hypotonic balance to change, you know, so it's like movement across the membrane of moisture. So some moisture will come across and they'll sort of deflate a little bit, but still retain that cellular crispiness. But if you throw in a lot of salt or sugar, some of those cellular barriers will start breaking apart and they'll become more sort of cooked as if they were cooked on a pan. And you kind of get into that area where it's not cooked enough and it's still slippery and sluggy. So yeah, it definitely can be done. And pickled mushrooms are on pretty much every culture on the planet has a version of pickled mushrooms.
Yeah. Do you ever work with this?
not for fable, but I mean for dishes for like what do you call it, antipasti. We often have like balsamic mushrooms, and then of course that in China is one of my very favorite dishes too, that woodier mushroom. So you can buy that in packets. They sort of hermetically seal and preserve them, and you can buy that in packets and just open them up and eat them straight out of the packet. So I bring a few back every time I go to China. Yeah.
Wow. Cool. I don't know why they're not. I keep telling everyone I don't know why they're not popular here in the States. Yeah. They're so good.
I don't know. Maybe it's just because they're black. Maybe it's just because it's the word mushroom. I don't know. I agree with you. They are. They're absolutely delicious, and anyone who's tried them loves them.
Yeah, and here in Texas, I don't know if you remember when you were back here, they grow so big.
Yeah.
I've never seen a big. They're the size of your head, and they're covering a whole stump, like a whole tree. They're amazing. And they're everywhere.
The most prolific mushroom I've noticed, at least in Austin. There's not many mushrooms around here, especially during the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, find that one. Yeah, find that one. Put it on a skewer. A little bit of oil, some seasoning, and then throw it on a barbecue. Throw it on a grill. It's so delicious.
I'll definitely have to try that. I know, you know, I've only had it in sweet and sour soup and the vinegar, but I like what you're saying about the slow cooking. That's really amazing. And you're really into cultivation, so I don't know if you've experimented with kind of the more esoteric trial and error R&D of using maybe different spices or herbs. I know there's a few stories of, you know, some traditional Chinese medicine practitioners growing, let's say, reishi off, you know, different herbs or ginseng or something like that. I don't know if you've tried to grow any mushrooms off any spices or anything like that in the substrate and, you know, or done any experiments like this to experiment with
flavor. So there are a few different woods that have sort of very interesting flavors that I've tried. Never really any success there. It seems to inhibit more than anything the growth of the mycelium.
Right.
But things that have high sugar content seem to have a good effect on the sweetness. So if you were to use corn cobs in your substrate, and then overdo it, use a lot of corn cobs in your substrate, you'll end up with something at the end that's really sweet. I haven't seen that play out with sort of bitterness, but I really haven't measured it so much. But the main thing here in Australia is that I have to find a wood that works. And with all the eucalypts, there are a lot of them that are just too gummy and resinaceous to end up with actual mushroom crops. So you kind of just go with what works here. And I hadn't had the ability to experiment with all that stuff that, you know, that like Gourmet Mushrooms was able to try, you know, throwing extra corn cobs and things like that in.
Yeah. Right. I had a conversation with a cordyceps farmer. Actually, they had the biggest cordyceps farm in the world in China. And they were saying the same thing, that they would – it's really funny because they had all these different types of cordyceps militaris that they were selling, and one was high in calcium, another one was high in selenium, another one, you know, is almost like a vitamin. And they had other ones that they're describing. Some they used a wheat substrate, others they used a rice, and he said, oh, the rice one is good for tea because it's really sweet. You know, the rice that has it's more sugary and it brings out the sweet flavor, so it's really nice to enjoy as a tea. Whereas the other one is it's better in other applications. So I like that. That's really awesome.
Yeah, that's a whole interesting field to get into with how the substrates will influence the flavor profiles and chemical profiles of the fungus. Yeah, we're so behind it.
Those mineral things that you talk about, like the calcium and selenium, you can kind of add those the last stage. So they're just kind of taking the water that you're putting on the surface and sort of inflating the mushrooms, you know, during sort of maturation and harvesting. So if you want to increase the mineral profile, that's the time to sort of really focus on doing that.
So, and on a similar line, have you ever played with using the substrate as the food, kind of like tempeh? I mean, obviously if you're growing this on wood chips, that's not an option.
For sure.
But if you grow on rice, I mean, we grew all of our cordyceps on rice and we would.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So spawn. I did that every day for a lot of years of my life, making spawn. So I definitely saw that that spawn could definitely be food. So definitely have played with lots of different things, additives to substrates that are then become edible. I didn't ever come across anything that I thought was amazing, but I thought a lot of things were interesting. It tastes like mycelium on whatever it is that you cooked. But I've gone so far as to, you know, look at, because I want to recreate the taste and texture of meat. So taking substrates that are, you know, sort of inherently fibrous and meaty. I've even used, you know, worked on fermentation of straw, like wheat straw, and then got that down to the point where it could actually be, you know, masticated, and then grew mushrooms on that to sort of knit it all together. It wasn't amazing, but again, it was something that was interesting, and maybe there's a, you know, an application down the track that something like that'll work out for. But yeah, absolutely. It grows around edible things and then becomes something else you can eat.
And this is a question, this is a really, really common question for people consuming mushrooms. I've heard a lot of people say, I'm allergic to mushrooms, period. Is that possible? And can you one, be allergic to all mushrooms or single mushrooms or a group, like all boletes, for example? And the second part of the question is, I heard that depending on what the substrate the mushroom is growing on, like particularly I heard this with chicken of the woods, and I can't remember what certain tree it grows on, maybe apple or something, that people have allergic reactions, but it's only 50% of the population or something. And you could serve the same dish and only 50% will be puking their guts out, and 50% was like, that was the most amazing mushroom dish ever.
Yeah.
So what's the truth behind all this?
Well, I wish I could reveal it all, but I've been through this for years, and I have experienced in my career only a couple of people who actually had true allergies. And the true allergies were related to one particular mushroom. So I have, of course, heard that people are allergic to whole families of mushrooms, or people are allergic to mushrooms in general, but I've never ever seen that actually true or play out, or I've never seen any works around it. But I have experienced people who have sensitivities to mushrooms and they feel really ill. And I think the main thing is, like, the actual glucan structure on the outside of the cell can be recognized by some people as pathogenic, and, you know, they'll mount an immune response that others just mount a general immune response and don't really react that heavily. But these people will have, like, knots in their guts, and they'll have sweats, and they won't feel very well. You know, it's not like a mushroom allergy is something that's, like, going to actually be fatal. But I really do think it relates down to the glucan structure of a fungal cell that kind of relates to what may be pathogenic, like a bacteria or a parasitic type of fungi. You know, your body just, you know, some people's bodies may just have those responses. So yeah, I don't know if it's actually true or not, but I do know that there are actually people out there who are allergic to one type of mushroom, and one of them is shiitake, and one of them is actually morel.
Isn't that potentially poisonous?
Yeah.
And there's a few mushrooms.
Yeah, so I can't remember if it's like hydrazine or jet fuel or something like that, the chemical related to in morel, but it has a very low sort of evaporation point. So as soon as it hits the pan, you can kind of, you know, above a certain temperature, you can be certain that it's not there. But yeah, it will make you vomit very violently if you consume them raw. Oh, and the second part of the question was, can you cook them to make them safe? And yeah, morel is one of them. Chicken of the woods is right. And if it's growing on eucalyptus, that'll make most people sick. So the resins in eucalyptus, and that's kind of one of the reasons we can't use all eucalyptus to grow mushrooms on, is they're sort of an antifungal sort of thing. So who knows what's going on? But yeah, that once that crosses into the mushroom, it's very difficult to cook it out, but you can. It takes like 10 or 15 minutes boiling really hard. Then you throw away the water, and then you can cook with the chicken. So we've done that before, and it works out. It works out quite nice. And so you still get to eat the chicken of the woods after it's been on those trees, but chuck it in boiling water, and you'll end up with nice chicken of the woods. And if you chuck it in red wine, you get salmon of the woods.
just like fiddleheads.
Yeah.
You know, you have to blanch it beforehand. And it's really interesting. I'm a little nervous when you have these really cool restaurants and they serve like wild mushrooms.
Mm,
and, you know, these foragers bring in, you know, all these wild mushrooms. And I always hear there's a lot of the chefs just like to cook them and eat them, but they're not ID experts. Mm, and maybe the person that brought it in just wants a quick buck and will mistake the ID. So has that ever happened to you? Or someone maybe brought in a mushroom and you're like, nope, that's not the right one.
Yeah. So most of the pickers, they know their stuff. They've been doing it for a really long time. And I got like firsthand view of this in the wholesale market. We had people coming to us to want to sell their hauls and get rid of their entire haul. I had some pickers come to me and say, look, I find this one all the time and I don't know what it is. Can I sell it? But they kind of vetted it through me. If I wasn't there, they probably would have just vetted it through somebody who thought they knew something and probably made it through. That was the most sort of awkward one that I saw. And the other one was Cordyceps gunnii. Here in Australia, there's cordyceps, there's several different types of endemic cordyceps. I bought off a picker very, routinely, and one day he sold me all of his pine mushrooms, his, saffron milk caps and his, slippery jacks. And in the backseat of his car, he had about a kilo picked of Cordyceps gunnii, and they were anywhere between, say 6 inches and 12 inches long. And I was like, what are you doing with those? Because there's no history of safe use of those things here in Australia. So I had known that they were here. I knew where to go pick them, all those things. And I knew everything about cordyceps that you could know. But then I saw a guy with them in the back of his car. Like, what are you doing? Are these edible? Do you know anything about them? And he's like, well, look, I don't know if they're edible, but I've been selling them to a chef for the past 25 years who puts them on his menu. He's requested them specifically, and it's always this type. He puts them on his menu. He absolutely loves them. So I at least know you can eat them. I don't know how safe they are. And I was like, man, I want them. Give them to me. I'll take them. I'll have these mushrooms. From now on, bring me whatever you find. Turns out, they are prolific in certain areas. So the guy ended up bringing me a ton of these things where we didn't really know what the market was and how to play into it. But from that point, I was enamored and like, okay, are we going to be able to use this? Is it actually a good cordyceps? So we went down the whole science path, having them compared to Militaris and compared to Sinensis and all these things. Turns out they're super functional. Couple of the indicative markers that were way off the charts, better than the Sinensis, and a couple that were just underneath, but all of them are there. The target therapeutic compounds are all there. So like, we've got this wonderful, amazing thing and we know it's all good. We know that it's got all these compounds that are great. We just don't know if it's got anything in there that is new or novel that could cause like long-term issues. So there was no like real push to get them out sort of mass market, but there was always a push to get them studied. And, you know, me knowing that these people have been using them for 25 years, that was enough for me and my knowledge of cordyceps up to this point to say, you know what, I'm going to start taking them. And from that point until today, I have been taking these cordyceps and they give me life. In the night wholesale market, that was the only thing that kept me alive. Energy, stamina, libido, it's all true. Definitely functional. Just amazing. And the ones here, they're so big. You get so much out of them.
Yes. They're huge.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking at the photos that you sent us. They're like the size of
yes.
my farm.
When we go to Australia, we gotta go cordyceps gunnii hunting. It's on my bucket list. Because they're massive. They're the size of your forearm.
I hear you.
Forearm.
I know.
And it's nuts. You can actually artificially cultivate them on rice.
They're pretty freaking special. So I know we are running long on time, but I did give these to Heston Blumenthal when we were in Thailand. And I gave him this little story about how we've tested them and how we know, and I eat them all the time. But there is a response in the community to cordyceps mushrooms when you have too much. And as far as I know, this is all cordyceps. And it comes down to, and the reason that people don't ever have too much is because they're just freaking expensive. And cordyceps militaris, they have such a small amount of the target therapeutic compounds that it's really hard to get this large amount of these things that actually, what it does is it offsets the timing from your neurons to your body, and it's almost universally presents itself as vertigo. That is like you're walking around and the world is like off its axis. So this happened to Heston. It happens to random people from random amounts of these things. And my boss, whenever I was in the wholesale market, he's a 65-year-old man. He, like me, started taking cordyceps every day, and it was great. But then he got a bit gluttonous once and ended up taking three of those sticks. We call them sticks because they're long, right? He ended up taking three of them because he was just so tired. But not only did he do that, he had two lattes and one bit of gum that had 25 micrograms of caffeine in it, and that did it for him. He just went vertigo. He started vomiting. He got crazy, and he went to the doctor. I took him to the hospital. I was like, I don't know what's wrong with the guy. And they said, look, we don't know either. His vital signs are great. He looks like an athlete. You know, obviously there's something going on neurologically. And it worked out that, yeah, it is this. It's like this misfire of neuron to body, and it can last a while. For him, it ended up lasting like 6 hours. And for Heston, it ended up lasting like 6 hours with tremors over the next couple of days. But that's just because Heston was a garbage guts. As soon as I told him this story and he got excited just like you, I said, look, just go easy. Have this tea that I've given you. And he's like, no, no, it's cool. I'll eat the whole thing. And he ate a stick right off the bat, just ate a whole stick. I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, look, you know, I've had that much. I've had lots. At one point, me and my really good friend, like, mashed up 12 sticks in one pot of tea, and we both drank it and just had a lovely day. So it affects people differently. And I don't know if it's an accumulation, and I don't know exactly how, but some days, some very small amount can actually do that to people who have used it for a long time. So I don't know, but I told him, I was like, look, if you start feeling vertigo, you're going to be in that world for a little while. I don't want you to get there. So stop eating these things. And he's like, I'll be fine. And I'm like, yeah, well, probably you will be. You're a garbage guts. You're a chef. You're just like me. You're going to be all right. And then that gave him enough courage to eat another stick. Oh, and of course.
And I'm sure the two coffees and the caffeine gum.
That put the guy over the edge. That put the boss guy over the edge for sure. And sure enough, when me and Heston were walking around on a mushroom farm in Thailand, the heat was just insane. And while we were walking into a growing room for reishi, and we were looking and saying, oh, that's amazing. And Heston was walking backwards like, I think I've got vertigo. And I'm like, yeah, mate. Yeah, you got vertigo. Let's go sit down. And yeah, that I almost thought I killed Heston Blumenthal. That was a terrible meeting.
Oh my goodness. Did you see the new study that came out with Cordyceps militaris being really, really helpful for jet lag? And it actually
makes a lot of sense.
The cordycepin molecule fastens to an enzyme called RUVBL2, mm-hmm. Which alters the transcription of your clock genes.
That's really interesting.
So, so next time you go to Thailand or come visit us in Texas, or we'll go to Australia. We'll take a bunch of Cordyceps militaris and just without
beautiful stuff,
espressos and a caffeine gum, and worry about
just don't overdo it. Everything in moderation, mate. And this thing is amazing. These cordycepin molecules and all the stuff that's going on, like at that level where it's transcribing differently, that's pretty interesting.
So this may take the cake for this next question, which is, what is some of the weirdest mushrooms you've ever eaten?
Yeah. Well, you've heard of the phallus mushrooms, phallus indusiata, phallus, the skirted
that's the weirdest
lady veil
she's ever eaten.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was pretty out there. And I got to eat it fresh in Thailand.
Did you eat the egg?
Yeah. So the collagenous, you know, stuff in the egg. Yeah. Just whole thing. And what was amazing about that stuff in Thailand, super hot, right? So if you rub that stuff on your skin, it's got a high amount of hyaluronic acid and a version of collagen that actually is quite protective. And it's like the only vegan version of collagen. So, you know, business adventure there.
Wow.
Wait, really?
There's a type of collagen in there and a high amount of hyaluronic acid. And there's something like 16 different collagens out there. I'm not sure which one is in this one. But yes, you rub it around on your skin. It'll sort of absorb into that outer layer, and it's cooling and it's protective against sort of the harsh rays of the sun. I'm not saying that it'll protect you from the UV, but it'll protect you from the UV damage. It sort of helps to repair with that. And it just super hydrating. So if you know, like, the silver cloud ear mushroom, super hydrating, got a high hyaluronic acid content, same deal here. So yeah, it's really good for you to eat. They make beverages and foods out of it there. So I was quite happy to have more of the preparations than just the fresh thing, but you gotta have the fresh thing at least once.
Definitely.
I still have not eaten it yet. It kind of freaks me out. It's almost like eating a fertilized egg, which I know is pretty popular in Southeast Asia. That's freaks me out. I'm not into it, but, I'll rub it on my skin. I'm all for that. I'm just, I have a whole video of watching Lyra eat this for the first time, and maybe, you know, if I'm really in the mood, I have a couple drinks in me, and it's presented, and I'm egged on, and
kick it off.
Sure.
With some
no pun
for
intended.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. On my Instagram highlights, I've got a video of Heston rubbing it all over his face in Thailand. So if you got a chance, go have a look there.
What's your Instagram name?
Good question. I think it's LongTallTex88. I think. Yeah, that's what it is, LongTallTex88.
Cool. We'll have it in the show notes for everyone if they want to check that out. So what about some creative dishes that you've made with mushrooms? Like, have you ever done really strange processings of them, like juiced them?
Yes, so the juice thing,
a volcano with some smoke of spores coming out of it.
Never that theatrical, other than like cooking in front of a people where we've just gone out into the woods and we've harvested everything out there that's edible and some of the things that are questionable, and we go through all of the, you know, taxonomy, and then we'll actually cut up and put the mushrooms in a dish. So those are actually the mushroom dishes that I've created that have the most sort of range and variety. We counted it up and I put in 14 different mushrooms into a mushroom soup that were all wild varieties, minus the agaricus that we had, cultivated agaricus. But the most flavorful marriage of just experience. It's so interesting. Everything that comes out of that walk, whenever we're walking around in the woods, I take an outdoor burner, like a fryer, you know, the big pots that people use for turkey frying. So I got that stand and I take walks out into the woods, and then we throw mushrooms in there, bottled water, garlic and salt, and people will have it. And then we'll do like progressions of dishes from here's what the mushroom tastes with just a little bit of olive oil, or boil it with water, then put a little olive oil at the end. That's what a mushroom tastes like all on its own. And people eat these mushrooms like straight off the ground into a pan, taste it and say, that's the meatiest, most delicious morsel of food I've ever had. And then we'll do that with a compilation of them. And then we'll take it and make a creamy side dish. And then we'll make a soup, all those sorts of things. So that's about as wild and crazy as I've gotten. And then, of course, like stuffing morels with, you know, truffle infused abalone.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
yeah, it was all about expensive. Yeah, we'll just put in everything, gold flakes and foie gras.
Yeah.
So I mean, at Biga, I got a chance to do a lot of that crazy sort of really expensive experience stuff. Yeah.
Have you ever worked with psilocybin in anything? I know, you know, I've seen a lot of people make gummies and lemon tech tea, and probably the most famous is peanut butter crackers. I hear that a lot. People taking, you know, if they don't want to eat it tastes the psilocybin. It's the peanut butter crackers.
It's astringent.
Have you ever worked with them?
To make them into a food. So I'll preface this by saying all of the work that I have ever done with these things has been in a legal environment. So, you know, wherever that was, it was at the time. So they were made into forms that with high fat content. So they're quite fat soluble. So butters, and then you can turn the butters into solid butter forms like chocolates. And then, of course, probably just the easier way to do any of those preparations is just into capsules with other really great synergistic brain things like hericium and, Phalaenus is actually quite good. It has three different types of, chemicals, compounds that'll cross your blood brain barrier. So that's another one that's super great for your brain.
I meant phallus.
I meant phallus. It was in my head. The Indusiata.
Oh,
yeah. So the actual, the veiled lady, the same one we were talking about was the weirdest experience. That actually has three different compounds in there that are quite strong.
I would never have guessed to pair that with psilocybin.
Yeah, well,
there you go.
You know, it fires off all of these interesting neural pathways. And whenever you have things that are known to sort of cross your blood-brain barrier, stack up along your myelin sheath, work to neural generation, it's just so synergistic whenever you've got all these new neural pathways firing, you've got all this stuff in there to support it. I feel invigorated, you know, when I was able to have those things on a daily basis. I felt very, very invigorated, energized, paired them up with cordyceps, so good, brain firing on all cylinders, just, But never as like a flavor, never as a flavor. It was always about covering up the flavor.
Yeah, it's very radical. There's a bit of a doctrine of signature with the Veiled Lady. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but it's basically just a term used to describe when the morphology of the food you eat benefits the organ or system in your body that resembles that. Yeah, I can totally, with the veil itself, it's...
Yeah, a network.
I guess you can make the argument. Totally.
That's the one.
Wow.
And it is interesting. I don't know if shamans or curanderos in Mexico still use this synergy, but back in the day, they used psilocybe with Cordyceps capitata and Tolipocladium ovoidosoides. So the Alaphomycete truffle or false truffle of these two species, they blended them together. So it's really interesting, more synergies of mushrooms with psilocybe. And I'm interested in all the different synergies from all different cultures around the world. It'd be interesting to see all the plethora of different,
there's so much knowledge out there. The Aboriginal culture in Australia has so much knowledge, but they don't write it down. They only pass it along. So you have to be like fortunate enough to know someone who can actually get you into a ceremony that you can be, you know, taught all those sorts of things. Yeah.
Right. And when you were in a legal setting with psilocybin, have you ever cooked under the influence of psilocybin? Did that change your cooking techniques?
Yeah.
A new view or connection to your
food? And it unfortunately took me right out of the cooking because that seems so mundane and not exciting enough, you know? So I know, but I have that culinary chef brain that loves to do this. So I just wanted to be more interactive with my surroundings and the people who are around me rather than cooking for them. So, I mean, I still made the food with care, but I did it in such a way that I did it straight through, no really talking, no sort of loving environment going into the food, serving it and then enjoying myself, you know, after having it and serving. But the cooking took me right out of it. Took me just away.
Well, I think there's medicine in there. You know, why do we cook in the first place? And one of the main reasons is to really come together with your friends and family and kind of crowd around this central piece of sustenance and need and you know, euphoria in your taste buds. So I think maybe that was a lesson. I don't want to speak for your experience.
No, that's my takeaway too.
You know, it's
absolutely.
Like emphasis on the people. You know, emphasis on like you're doing this to connect with people and connect with people.
100%. Yeah. No, that's exactly my takeaway. It was that these people are important to you. Make the food with love, but get to them. You know, just you need to interact with them rather than with these inanimate objects that are in the pan.
So we've been focusing a lot on kind of the fleshy bodies of fruiting body fungus, you know, and there are many different ways to interact and kind of create beverages and foods with fungi apart from actual mushrooms. What have you worked with? You know, kombucha, for example, is a great example of a SCOBY, and there's yeast, and you can do so much with yeast, and I'm sure a lot of people work with yeast every day and eat yeast and have no idea that's fungi. So Do you have any favorite ways to work with fungi outside of?
Well, yeah, so many, but I think I'd focus on the enzyme stuff that they have really makes them interesting to work with wood and waste wood. So you can break down waste wood and then do something with that. So, taking the used substrate from a mushroom farm and then, you know, some degree put it back into the mushroom farm, but to another degree, you could take that and utilize it not just for cropping. There are like middle steps where you could actually do some more interesting things with it. Actually one of the applications that I loved was utilizing it as a biofilter for aquaponic scenarios. So you're actually collecting all the solids from that sort of thing and then letting that compost, it just kicks off the bacteria and the other fungi that sort of get that stuff to a state where you can put it back in the ground and it's all nutrient. It's all available for the plant. So that's one thing. And then of course, kombucha, making bread, making alcohol, all those sorts of things. And I do a lot of those just, you know, interesting and weird ways, utilizing mushrooms to make structures. So, you know, actually using the mycelium as glue. And then making the mycelium leather, really something that, you know, I was about to step away and start doing before I got into Fable. But yeah, making the mycelium into a leather product is really, really, mesmerizing. For one, you can develop such interesting structures that look so animal-like in their skin patterning and all that. So yeah, I mean, that is a large bunny hole in its own, just all the different applications.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Telluride Mushroom Festival?
I haven't. No, I learned about that whenever I was in California on the way to Australia. So I only lived there a couple of years, didn't get out. And then ever since, you know, for another 13 years, been over here and never got the opportunity to go back. But I meet so many people in the science world who actually like to go to that. And then, you know, I'll meet them in China or I'll meet them in Europe whenever we go to mushroom conferences. Yeah. So those are my those are my times to be Telluride.
Yeah, if you ever get a chance, you know, if you're ever in the States again around the same time around Colorado, it's unbelievable. And I bring that because there's an amazing US-based mycologist, Chad Cotter, and he makes mushroom beer for the festival. And he makes all these different varieties. And it's great. He has them on tap. And it's just a great time to have a few beers with some mycologists, and he has, you know, one of my favorite is the Lion's Mane Pale Ale.
Yeah.
He always says, you know, kill some brain cells and regrow them. And, I actually learned that you can replace hops with turkey tail.
Really?
Or reishi in the beer making process. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you're a beer maker.
We're actually making a cordyceps beer for one of the festivals coming up here. So knowing that that's a thing.
With
Gunny Eye. Yeah.
Oh my God.
We gotta go to Australia. We've been talking to so many people in Australia, and it's the fungal diversity there too is so impressive.
Yeah, no, we've got that 500 million year separation from Gondwana land. So we've got like 300 known types of truffle-like mushrooms, which is a whole thing itself. Like they're called truffle-like. These are adaptive structures. They're not primitive structures. Because of the really harsh environment in Australia, these same mushrooms that grow on the surface in the northern hemisphere actually grow under the ground here, and they've adapted with the same genetics, the ability to release pheromones and attract the local marsupial animals that actually use them as a high percentage of their diet. So they'll come along and dig up these truffle-like fungi that have remnants of their structures of being on the surface. So they still have like the remnants of a stipe and lamellae and they sporulate inside, but because they no longer disseminate through, you know, wind and rain, they have to get another way of disseminating spores. They let off these pheromones. They change their phenotype. They've adapted. So what's really interesting for medicinal mushrooms here in Australia, that harsh environment that forces these adaptations for them to do different chemical things, that's really, really interesting for medicinal and you know, food research, just for their functionality. Yes, Australia is amazing for that.
We have one final question, and I thank you ahead of time for being on our show. This has been awesome. You are very experienced in many different avenues with fungi. So I can't wait to meet you in person.
Same, very much the same. Thank you.
Of course, Subskania and many more adventures.
Yeah, we'll bring all the toys.
So the question is, if mushrooms had the microphone and could say one thing to the whole human race, what would they say?
I've thought about this long and hard because I hear it often on your podcast. And I'm really conflicted about what I think they would say. I honestly think that they're a prescient being. They've been here. They helped terraform the planet. We've been here for a very small speck of their time. And I've accepted the view that we are potentially an expression of them, like an offshoot, a child, or a project that they watch, hopefully lovingly. So without thinking that they have sort of too much judgment, I would think that they would say, we love you, we see you, we vibrate with you. The choices that you're making aren't ones that we would necessarily make, and if you could just look to us, you can see how to better use your resources and potentially not occupy so many areas so densely, maybe move out a bit and sort of spread the resources, or just mimic us and you know, don't put a whole lot of effort into multiplying so much in those areas. Multiply out and then use the resources more efficiently and find better ways. Look to us to understand how to use those resources. And then when you're gone, we will miss you, but we will thrive and we'll persist and all of, yeah. I think that's where I sit with that.
I can tell that you meditated on that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the opportunity to, yeah, to put that out for sure.
It's really humbling to be viewed as a little pet project for fungi. That's so awesome.
Yeah. I think that, you know, just like a parent with a child that's sort of gone crazy, they're just like biting their fists and saying, you know, we love you. We're not going to kill you. We're not going to get rid of you. You know, we're not just going to shun you. But, you know, look to us. You've cut off from us for so long. Right. Just come back. Come back. I don't know. That's what I feel.
The UFOs that are coming out, you know, those are just the mushrooms. All the UFO abduction stories, they're just mushrooms taking it up to the mothership.
Yes.
Saying, hey.
That's another project.
Right. And so how can people follow you? We got your Instagram, so and do you have a website?
So my personal one is that @longtalltex88 on Insta, and then longtalltex on Twitter. And then Fable is @fablefoodco on Insta, and then fablefood.co. For the website.
Incredible.
Awesome.
And thank you so much for everyone tuning in and shrooming in. That's another episode of the Mushroom Revival Podcast. We love you so much. We're sending everyone a massive fungal virtual hug during this time, and we can't wait to see everyone in person when the time allots. So everyone, check us out at www.mushroom-revival.com. You can see the rest of our podcasts on there. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button and give us a rating, whatever feels legit to you. If it's 1-star or 5-star, whatever feels genuine, we respect that. And share it with your friends on social media or in person, if you have in-person social interactions right now. And yeah, we love you so much. Much love, and may the spores be with you.
Much love.